today, is the US v. China true? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, world's latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And I'm joined today by Salvatore Babonis, who's the Associate Professor at the University of Sydney. Hello, Salvatore. Good to see you again.
Hi, Martin. Thanks for having me back on.
It's great to have you on, and specifically as your guests are a US guy in Oz. I thought this would be a really interesting conversation to have with you. Now, I did a show last week with one of our other contributors, and we tried to start to get into this whole concept of US and China and how these two giant powers are sort of interacting with each other and how the fallout potentially can hit the Australia and everybody else too. So, I mean, I've almost got this vision of these two monsters, you know, fighting it out, and everybody gets hit in the crossfire. I mean, whether am I right, am I wrong, or how do you see
well, it? Well, these days there's three monsters because in U.S. foreign policy doctrine, the Pacific Command has since become the Indo-Pacific Command, and the U.S. has theorized this hinge around China with Japan on one side, maybe in India, four monsters, Japan on one end, India on the other, boxing China in like a pincer or a set of jaws. And who's at that fulcrum? Well, the U.S. Marines in Darwin. So Australia is right there as part of this grand plan. So Australia plays actually an outsized role in current American strategic thinking about the Indo-Pacific region.
Right, and that's because of our geographic location and providing access to the broader region, presumably.
Well, the geographic location, but also the bedrock alliance. I mean, people here in Australia may raise questions, U.S. versus China, and it's a popular topic to get people excited about foreign policy. Should Australia change its allegiance to China or adjust to a multipolar world? But let's face it, the fact is that the chances of a China-Australia alliance are exactly zero. Australia is going to remain a bedrock partner of the United States in the Indo-Pacific region forever. That is not going away. Now, I know it does sometimes upset U.S. policymakers when there are these discussions in Australia about should Australia choose an independent path, but I don't think it's very likely that Australia will ever choose an independent path. Australia is one of the closest allies of the United States. I mean, excepting really only the United Kingdom, and even that, depending on what government is in the United Kingdom, Australia is an unquestioned and indispensable partner of the United States. And the U.S. Indo-Pacific doctrine really does place Australia at a very high level in U.S. strategic thinking.
Right. Very interesting. And, the relationship between Australia and the U.S. has been going on for quite some time. And as you say, it's a very deep and very multifaceted. It's got, an exchange of intelligence, a common view of, I think, the financial system, all of those sorts of things, and I guess a common alignment around what's important, right, politically speaking.
Well, it's a very deep connection. I mean, Australians teach at U.S. Military academies. There's virtually nothing you can do in the U.S. military that an Australian isn't allowed to do. Maybe they can't access nuclear codes. I don't know about that. But short of Armageddon, Australia is deeply embedded in U.S. Strategic thinking and in practice. And that, for me, is really the crucial point. It's not just about the United States, the country of the United States versus the country of China and some kind of, Godzilla versus King Kong fight in the Pacific Ocean. It's about integration. And the American system integrates people from Australia, from the United Kingdom. I think of it as like a first circle, which would be the English-speaking countries and the Five Eyes contributors. But then there's a second circle of people from NATO allies, from Japan and South Korea, who also integrate into a U.S. strategic system. And not just at the country-to-country level, also at the person-to-person level. I mean, let me make this practical. When an Australian helicopter goes or learns, so an Australian helicopter pilot learns how to attack ground troops during a firefight undercover from high altitude aircraft and drones. They use U.S. strategic doctrine U.S. tactical doctrine in doing that. That is, Australians learn how to operate a helicopter in the U.S. manner. So the very training they get is intended to be interoperable with American training, and not just Australians. So, of course, all the NATO militaries do that, but also non-NATO, non-Five Eyes militaries that seek to cooperate with the United States and the free world in operations. Thus, when you see something like a freedom of navigation operation in the Persian Gulf, which an Australian frigate participated in last year, there are already a whole set of training procedures that Australians understand how to operate with their American counterparts because they've received the exact same training. You know, when they want to know how do you lift a boat from the water up to the larger ship, they do it in the same way. And that may sound trivial, but it means that Australians can be rescued at sea by Americans without any friction between them. And that's really what interoperability is all about. That deep connection goes much deeper than the political allegiances of the day.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, now let me just sort of pivot then towards the China-Australia relationship, because clearly that is based strongly around we dig up stuff out of the ground and sell it to China, and we import stuff from China. So it's very much a trade relationship. It feels very different to the one between Australia and the US.
It is purely transactional. And this is something that is a problem for China in all of its foreign relations. You're probably familiar with the Belt and Road Initiative, or One Belt, One Road. That's the new Silk Road economic belt, which is the belt half, which goes from China across Central Asia to Europe, and the 21st century maritime Silk Road, which theoretically connects China via Southeast Asia to the Indian Ocean and Africa. This Belt and Road Initiative is China's flagship foreign policy initiative. The problem China has is that it has to transactionally buy allies along the Belt and Road. Now, people get very worried. China invests in a port in Sri Lanka. China builds a port in Pakistan. And people say, oh, that's China taking over. I look at it completely differently. If China wants a port in Pakistan, it has to pay for it. You know, if China wants a port in Sri Lanka, it has to pay for it. On the other hand, when the United States wants to access ports in places like Darwin or throughout the world, for that matter, in Yokohama, in Japan, other countries welcome the United States into their facilities. And that's really the difference. The Australian relationship with China is purely transactional. And last week, the Chinese ambassador made that very clear when he said, if Australia didn't let up on the pressure for an international investigation, then China would potentially embargo Australia for international students, embargo Australia for sending Chinese tourists to Australia, embargo Australia for beef purchases and for wine purchases. Now, interestingly, he didn't mention the one that really matters, iron ore. That's because China needs Australia for its iron ore. But this highlights how transactional the relationship is. You know, Andrew Forrest highlights how transactional the relationship is. China buys iron ore, they get an ally in Australia's iron ore industry. But if China stopped buying iron ore, those alliances would disappear. And that's very different from the Australia-United States relationship, where the U.S. doesn't really have to pay Australia anything. The Victorian government wants to join or has joined China's Belt and Road Initiative and is sitting there waiting for the investment dollars to roll in. Why did they join Belt and Road? Purely for transactional reasons. It's not that the Andrews government in Victoria somehow feels close to the Chinese Communist Party, though some conservatives in Australia may think that he does. But there's no truth to that. It's simply that they want Chinese investment in Victoria, and they're willing to give back in exchange some kind of propaganda victory for China. China has to buy its friends. It's purely transactional. And that's completely different from the U.S. relationship with other countries, including Australia. The United States does not subsidize Australia. The United States does not offer Australian states sweeteners if they will somehow support American foreign policies. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. Countries like Australia contribute to American foreign policy objectives. Australia suffered mightily in Vietnam for the sake of American foreign policy efforts. They suffered in Iraq. They suffered in Afghanistan. They've sent frigates to the Persian Gulf. And last week, 2 weeks ago, an Australian, I believe it was an Australian destroyer, participated in U.S. freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. So it's not that the U.S. buys its friends. It's almost like when it's time to pay the piper pays Uncle Sam.
Okay, very interesting there too. Now, then the next angle I think to explore is, if you like, the political dynamic within you know, the US versus China, because clearly China is centralized, controlled, top down, you know, thou shalt. US a bit less so, although actually still, I think, strengthening power at the center at the moment, is the way I read it.
There's a lot of power in the executive in the United States as long as the executive is doing something popular. Minute the executive does something that people don't like, he gets sued, he gets resistance from Congress. So, I mean, we shouldn't overestimate the rise of the executive state in the United States. Sure, there's more presidential power now than there was 40 or 50 years ago, but that power can always be checked anytime the president does something that people don't like, as we've seen with Donald Trump trying to take control of national coronavirus policy. The states immediately, you know, stepped in and said, no, you know, we're going to be in charge, and the president had to step back. Now, that's a feature of the United States system. The United States, of course, is very pluralistic. There are regional biases, and there are regional-based politics, as well as, of course, the two major parties, the Democrats and Republicans, constantly battling it out. But that has very little to do with China. In fact, the president, President Trump, has been roundly criticized by Democrats for being, wait for it, too soft on China. So it's not, there's not an issue that if the presidential election goes towards the Democrats, and if the Democrats take control of the Senate in 2021, that we'll see somehow a change in U.S.-China relations. Having dug the hole, the Democrats are going to have to lie in it, where they have been criticizing the president for 4 years for being too close to China. Unbelievable maybe to an outsider, but that's the way it is. And that's because American foreign policy really isn't about party politics. It's really about American national interests. There are vast differences between the parties in the United States when it comes to domestic policy, when it comes to issues like abortion, when it comes to issues like states' rights, gun control, national health care, the taxes. These issues severely divide American politics. Foreign policy is much more the realm of wonks like me. You know, we have very serious battles over foreign policy. But the politicians usually line up on, let's face it, the American side.
No surprise there then.
Yeah.
Okay. And in terms of the evolution of China, so there are some people who are saying, well, yeah, China behaves the way it does now because of where it is on its evolutionary path, right? Give it another 5, 10, 15 years, and it will have established such a beachhead of power and influence, and it will actually be much more strong financially as well. And therefore, trying to compare the two today is like comparing, you know, the US 50, 100 years ago with China today. What's your thoughts around that? Or is it a fundamentally different wiring, as it were?
So there are three big problems for China, and I'll start with the smallest one and then get to the biggest one.
Okay.
The smallest problem is exponential growth doesn't last forever. I've been writing since 2010 that China's growth curve would end in the 2020s. And I think that finally, the current crisis is going to be the moment when even China admits that its economy is no longer growing. In my own view, China's economy stopped growing around 2017, but they've continued to pump out statistics saying that they're growing. Those statistics have become less and less tied to reality. I mean, even before the current crisis, China had declining auto sales, declining mobile phone sales, flat exports. It's hard to imagine that its economy was growing at 6.5% with those kinds of real statistics. Currently, even China has admitted that its economy has shrunk. I think its economic growth is over. China was talking about building a whole fleet of aircraft carrier task forces. It built two, it had one training ship, then two aircraft carriers. Now it has delayed the third one. It's delayed building support ships for those carriers. China's aircraft carriers pretty much do nothing but sail back and forth through the Taiwan Strait, East China Sea, South China Sea, East China Sea, South China Sea, on perpetual training missions. China simply doesn't have the revenues, the tax revenues, to continue to develop its military the way it has said it would. Same thing with Belt and Road projects. China has promised some, if you look at news reports, some say $800 billion in Belt and Road projects. But we don't see the projects actually being built. It's the same announcements every year of projects that haven't been built. Last year, they make an announcement of, oh, this project is on the drawing board. Sometimes those projects sit on the drawing boards in the proposal stage for 5 or 10 years and just get reannounced and reannounced and reannounced. The press doesn't notice that, but the academic observers do. So first, I think that exponential growth that China was in has now flattened out, and it's not going to come anywhere near the GDP per capita of the United States. Second problem, automatic stabilizers. As Japan, as China becomes more hostile, its neighbors arm in defense. So as China expands in the East China Sea, Japan has been rearming. I mean, Japan has bought, triple digits of F-35 fighters from the United States. Well, why is Japan buying F-35s? To maintain air supremacy over the East China Sea. Japan has converted two of its helicopter carriers into quasi-aircraft carriers. Now, we always knew they could. Why have they done it now? Because China's building aircraft carriers. If China didn't have any aircraft carriers, Japan didn't need them. If China's going to have them, Japan's going to have them. And that's despite having a pacifist clause in its constitution that prevents it from having armed forces. South Korea has no such clause. South Korea, of course, is very heavily armed. Despite Chinese threats to cut off trade, South Korea still put in a U.S. theater high altitude area defense missile system, which has a radar system. It's nominally there, and it is there, to defend against North Korean missiles. But its radar system covers all of Northeast China, including Beijing. And so South Korea, despite threats of Chinese economic retaliation, has been arming in response to China's increased military threat. Taiwan, which for years let its military deteriorate, is now suddenly once again interested in buying U.S. equipment. For years, it didn't even buy the quota it was allowed to buy in U.S. equipment because cross-strait relations were silent. Nothing was going on. Now, all of a sudden, Taiwan wants anti-missile rockets, submarines. You know, it's on a buying spree, and fighter aircraft. Why? Well, obviously because of China's increasing threat. Vietnam is undergoing military modernization, again, because of the China threat. Even the Philippines, where I don't want to throw around the word crazy, so I won't say it, where the president, Rodrigo Duterte, flirted a few years ago with an alliance with China, you know, has now backtracked and keeps pointing out that he has a defense commitment from the United States to defend the Philippines. And of course, the big one on the other side is India. India is modernizing, not with U.S. weapons, ironically with Russian weapons, but nonetheless modernizing its armed forces in response to an increased China threat. So these automatic stabilizers kick in. If China wants to become more threatening, its neighbors seek to defend themselves. And thus China, even without any increase in an American presence, China makes no net gain when it arms itself or when it takes a hostile stance. But third and most important, I'm not a military guy. I'm not an economist. I'm not a military analyst. I'm a sociologist. And for me, the most important issue in U.S.-China relations is that individual Chinese people want to be part of that larger U.S. system. Now, I know that right now there are issues with international education, and we had a whole show on that. But, you know, where do Chinese parents want their kids to go? They want them to go to Harvard and Stanford, ideally, if they can get them in. You know, if they can't get them into Harvard and Stanford, they want them in schools that are closely aligned politically with the United States in places like Australia, United Kingdom, and Canada. Where do they want to go for migration? Well, their top visa for a Chinese national is to get a U.S. visa. I mean, a green card is gold, as they say. Anchor babies in the U.S. are diamonds, right? If you can get a baby with U.S. citizenship, that gives your family this opportunity to make a long-term transition and upgrading from Chinese to U.S. citizenship. Now, as long as rich and middle-class Chinese people prefer to be part of the larger American system, China doesn't stand a chance.
I hadn't thought of it so powerfully as people want to move.
They don't want the Western stuff.
Okay.
They want the American stuff.
Okay.
and that's very clear. Yeah. You know, it's the U.S. dollar they want, not the euro. Right. It's U.S. citizenship they want, not German citizenship or Italian citizenship. European, other Western countries, they're okay as a substitute. But the number one place they want to integrate with is the United States. And that preference rebounds inside China's politics. Because if China has a whole swath of upper middle class and rich people who want good relations with the U.S., it's very difficult for the Chinese government to cut that off. I mean, consider the yuan. China wanted to make the yuan a reserve currency and encourage people to invest in the yuan. Yet even China's own people prefer to invest in dollars. So China has had to put ever more stringent exchange controls in place to prevent people from exchanging their yuan for U.S. dollars. In theory, every Chinese citizen can buy 50,000 American dollars of foreign exchange every year. In practice, it's virtually impossible for them to do so. First, it's worth noting, everything in China is denominated in dollars. It's $50,000 they're able to buy. You can then benchmark that to euros. The Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, China's Belt and Road Investment Bank, based in Beijing, raises its capital in U.S. dollars and makes its loans in U.S. dollars. Everyone below the central leadership, everyone below the Politburo level, prefers to do business in that larger American world. And thus we see things like the AIIB, which was supposedly a tool of Chinese influence around the world. The AIIB has signed on to World Bank lending standards. The World Bank, of course, is based in Washington and dominated politically by the United States. By tradition, always has an American as the president of the World Bank. And they have signed on to World Bank standards. And in fact, a large proportion of their lending, about, I think it's around one third, is simply lending to World Bank projects. So instead of competing with the American development finance system, they're buying into it. Now, you don't hear that at the rhetorical level, but that's what professionals want to do. And this is true at every field. Chinese academics want to publish in U.S. journals. Chinese people want U.S. credentials. And it doesn't matter what field you look at. The individuals within China are trying to be part of that larger American system. I wrote all about this. I have a 2017 book, just to show it to you, American Tianxia. Tianxia is the Chinese word for world, all under heaven. And the argument of this little book, little thin book, is that Chinese people have bought into the American-centered world. Even if they dislike the United States, they want to dislike the United States on Twitter or on Facebook. They want to dislike the United States with U.S. dollars. And they want to dislike the United States in New York. They don't want to dislike the United States in Beijing. And that structural feature of the world that has resulted from globalization has made it very difficult for challengers. I mean, let me just raise one more point. A lot of people like to compare the current situation to the situation before World War I. And they say that a rising power threatens to invade the rest of the world. Well, back in World War I, if you were German and you wanted to get your kid into Oxford, you had to invade England and take over Oxford, right? I mean, and that's literally what it was about. If you wanted access to a coal field in France, you had to invade France and take the coal field. Now in a globalized world, if you want a coal field in Pennsylvania, just invest in a coal field in Pennsylvania. I mean, America's largest pork producer is a Chinese company because, they bought Smithfields and now Smithfields is a Chinese company. And globalization has made it possible for individuals to go out and participate in the best of the world, even while leaving their countries behind. And that's the big difference between the 21st century and the 20th.
Mm. So last question for today, Salvatore, is there's a lot of talk now about the breakdown of globalization and the fact that people are perhaps pulling their horns in and realizing that these massively long supply chains were perhaps disruptive, that globalization wasn't always positive. Does that change the relationship between China and the US, or is that just a sideshow?
Right. So first, it's not even happening. So I have an article on Foreign Policy Magazine from 2 weeks ago. I can give you a link, pointing out that although people have talked about supply chains breaking, in fact, you can't point to any supply chains that have broken. In fact, even very complicated products like automobiles and mobile phones have not missed a beat of production due to the current crisis. They have had dramatic demand collapses. So people don't want to buy automobiles and mobile phones. But if you want to buy a car, they'll love to sell you one. If you want to buy a mobile phone, they'll love to sell you one. Production networks have not broken down. They haven't even missed a beat. Okay. If they had, if it really was true that people would deglobalize, well, then the main loser is China. Right? China is the one who needs globalization. And China is in this catch-22 situation. In order to beat the US, in order to become a new center, they have to do it. They have to break these global links and instead go out on their own. As long as they're in a chain that leads ultimately to the United States, well, they can climb up that chain, but they can never take it over. Witness Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, they've all climbed up these chains. And everyone said in the 1990s or 1980s, Japan is going to be the new number one, as they said, because it was climbing up the chain. Yep. But you can't climb up a ladder and get in front of the person at the top of the ladder. And that was Japan's problem. It got stuck behind the United States in those chains. Now, China understands this, and China has been toying with breaking those chains and making its own. The problem is, if they break those chains, then they lose access to the technology, they lose access to the capital. And that's what we've seen in China's internet. China has internet giants, Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, to rival the American giants, but they can't compete outside China. They're only able to compete in their walled garden. And that's the problem for China. Technologically, it lags behind. It can be a fast follower if it participates in globalization. But the minute it severs those links, it can no longer follow. So China's in this catch-22 that it can't get out of. It needs globalization much more than the United States does.
Well, that's fascinating, Salvatore, because you've demythologized a lot of the issues relating to the so-called, you know, China-US contention. And I think your perspectives are really powerful. So I appreciate your time today. And we'll put the links in the comments below to those articles that you mentioned, because I'm sure people will want to follow up. And we'll come back and have another go at this a bit down the track, I think, because I'm sure there's more we can talk about.
Always happy to talk. This is the heart of my own research, and always love to talk about it.
Appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So there you have it, a really interesting perspective from Salvatore. And the conclusion is that the idea of saying it's US v. China or China v. US is perhaps missing the point. There are some fundamental differences between the relationships that exist between those two domains and indeed the behavior within them. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.